You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 417. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you here in my basement, Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on the program tonight, only joining me on the program tonight, is Mr. John Gentile. John, we're alone.
Just the two of us. You, what's that song? You and me.
We can make it if we try. Anyways, yeah, no one signed on for this week. So this wasn't meant to be a solo thing, a duo thing.
The bad duo.
That's it. Everyone else succumbed to the plague, I guess. So we're going to talk about some stuff. We're going to talk about a bunch of various, I'd say this is a weird grab bag of news that we have to go through this past week, but we're going to give it a shot. How's everything going in your neck of the woods, John? How are things in East Coast,
Philadelphia? I think things are going.
Can we say that? I thought you were hiding.
Oh, yeah, I was. Well, whatever. 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 Anyways, things are going pretty good. Punk news, we got an exciting end of October coming up. Let's see what else is happening. Let's see. I'm pulling a plane on Thursday.
You're pulling a plane?
So through the Bar Association, it's raising money for UNICEF for some, and basically whoever can pull a plane with a rope across the finish line quickest gets money for UNICEF. And I don't exactly understand how, but that's what I'm doing.
Like alone or with a team?
Alone, baby. I think it's like a prop plane.
Oh, it's like a Cessna. It's not like a Harrier jet or something.
So Hercules himself, me, will be pulling a plane. I don't know who came up with this, honestly. It sounds like some people just got like highs. Yeah, man, what if you raise money by having people pull planes? Yeah, man.
Well, I mean, I wish you luck in this. Whatever that you found yourself in.
Another thing is I interviewed Dan Burt No Bacon of Chumbawamba, and he was cool as hell. And honestly, I kind of wish I had put more time aside to it. It's just like a Q&A. I kind of wish I did a profile. So we will be doing more Chumbawamba stuff in 2019, Adam, which I'm very excited about. Very, like, he was cool.
John, wishing you had more time for things is my current existential crisis.
Well, so. Do tell, Adam.
I've just had a long weekend up here in Canada. It was Canadian Thanksgiving, which is like Thanksgiving only up north. And
what would the name of Canadian Ben Franklin be? Like what's Benjamin in French?
Like Canadian Ben Franklin would be like Pierre or something or other. Like
Pierre,
yeah, it'd be
Francois.
A French spot. Pierre, I don't know.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm going to throw any assorted French last name, and that's going to be a person, and I'm not going to recognize in my tired brain who that is, and it's going to offend someone. So if I went like, Pierre LeBlanc, I'm not going to be thinking of who the real Pierre LeBlanc is, but someone's going to write in and be like, you know, he was an FLQ terrorist in the 60s, you bastard, or something. I don't know. Anyways, yeah, I don't know. Canadian Thanksgiving is fine. John, I just had 3 days off, and one would think that with time off from work and things like that, I wouldn't be feeling like I have like no time for anything. But John, I feel like I have no time for anything, and I hate that feeling.
Welcome to being an adult, Adam. Get used to it.
I don't like it. So me, I mean, case in point, and I'm just gonna drag this right way up in the schedule here. So there's a fucked up record that came out. Were you aware of this?
Not only am I aware of it, Adam, it is marvelous. It is marvelous, fantastic. And I think, honestly, I think Mike Halichuk of F'd Up doesn't like punk news. But So I'm wrestling with the issue of some of your favorite artists don't need to be your best friend, honestly.
Ah, that's okay. I don't care what Mike Halachek likes or doesn't like. He's a difficult guy, and I give him that.
He is. Right?
But
Damien likes us, though, after I dissed him last episode, which I feel bad about. Damien, I'm sorry. I kind of came down hard on you. I was wrong. You were nice. I like you. Please stay in effed up. We need you in effed up. I'm sorry, Adam. Go ahead.
Okay. So there's an effed up record that came out. You and I are intimately aware that this was an occurrence that was about to happen. Now, you, through some skullduggery, had heard the record prior to now. I had not, just because I don't have time to go engage in the level of you know, PR glad handling that I would have needed to do to get on that list or whatever, right? There was no point where I said, I should go talk to the appropriate person and get a copy of this fucked up record. Didn't happen. So I'm like, I'm going to wait like one of the people for this record to come out. And I'll listen to songs when they show up in the PR feeds, but that's all. So finally the record is out, and I have no time, John. I have no time to sit down for how long is this record? It's long. It's
like 96 minutes or something like
96
that.
Minutes. John, I did not have 96 consecutive minutes in the past 4 days in which I could sit down and listen to this fucker. I barely had time to listen to the new Tommy and the Commies record, which is 17 minutes long. So I don't understand how I'm supposed to do this. I finally at work today, I was able to listen to it in like four chunks, with the exception of the last two songs. So I don't want to talk about those because I haven't heard them. So if the whole thing goes completely off the fucking rails on track 17 of this fucked up thing, I won't be able to comment on that. But it's weighing on me that like I have somehow not eked out like a contiguous hour and a half where I wasn't doing something to be able to listen to a piece of music that I think is going to be very important to me. Like I feel ashamed of this, not super ashamed, because most of those minutes were spent either like, you know, earning money for my family to not live in a box, or spending time with my children and loved ones on a holiday or whatever. Like I'm not going to rend my clothes in guilt over this, but I still kind of feel like I'm behind everything. I don't know how do I get up? How do I get back? Right.
Adam, I was thinking of this. You need to listen to music in your car. You don't listen to music in your car. That's primo listening space.
But yeah, you should see my fucking podcast list of 600 episodes in it right now that I haven't listened to. Like I'm looking right now at my record player, and stacked between my turntable and a speaker that is next to my turntable, and I know you're not supposed to do that, stacked between those two things are like two dozen records that I have not filed into a shelf, because I committed at some point where everything was going to get into Discogs before it gets into the shelf, and that has not been done. Like I need vacation time to sort the fucking records on the table. And there's not that many of them. This isn't like a Ricky Franco quality quantity of records where, you know, 300 have shown up in the past week and a half. This is stuff that I've acquired over the last 6 months, and it's just sitting in a heap. And I don't know what to do.
Well, how ironic in that the new effed up album is about having time get ahead of you, and you look back and it's been 20 years. Much like a Pink Floyd album would comment upon, and you haven't gotten to the things that you wanted to do in 20 or 30 years have gone by, and you're in a spot that you don't want to be in, and how can you rectify that, or is it already too late? Which is the theme of the new effed up album, Adam. How fitting.
Oh, great. So when I am, what, 65, I will finally have listened to this fucked up record.
Yes, but then you'll meet an old woman, and she'll be like, my boyfriend went through a psychic void, and I want you to go into the same psychic void and find him. And then you'll do that, and you'll meet an astral angel, and she'll explain the mysteries of the universe to you and how everything is a simulation built upon a simulation. And then you'll achieve transcendence by breaking through the artificial shroud and become at one with yourself and the universe.
Oh, fuck. I hope so, because that's really that's the only thing I can count on right now. One of the amazing things about this record is that for all the potential for it to be heady or pretentious based on that crazy narrative that you just laid out there, it's rather accessible. Like the, like, in particular, I want to say, like, everything from the, like, if we divide this thing into thirds, let's say, like, everything from, say, Dose Your Dreams, and the four or five songs that follow it, not just the ones where Damien is no longer doing the main vocals on it, but even the ones where he is, they're fairly poppy during that section of the record. And, like, in a way that I'm using that as the most complimentary way that I can. Like, I feel like on songs like, say, like Living in a Simulation or I Don't Want to Live in This World Anymore, Damien is not, he's probably singing a little bit more than I think I've ever heard him. Right. There's something really interesting about how this record doesn't, like, it's high concept, but it's not trying to art rock you, you know? Like, they're putting a lot into it, but it's never trying to be obtuse from a musical standpoint. It's interesting from a musical standpoint, but it's not trying to purposefully be difficult. And I think that's a pretty amazing thing, because usually when people think about, oh, I'm going to go as high concept as I can, that results in, you know, people noodling away and just making a bunch of nonsense for the sake of being, you know, complicated. But I don't get that feeling from this record.
You could argue that's because the band didn't set out with high concept and then decided how to put it together. They just started jamming, and as they jammed, the record formed around their jamming and experiments, which sometimes makes messy records, but often makes amazing records. The Rolling Stones' Exile Main Street. I'm trying to think what else to start. Sandinista, Clash's London Calling. All of those records start out with just the band jamming with no grand plan, and they just were in the zone, and it locked together and became something amazing. I agree with your analysis, but I would say this record does not try to be a masterpiece. It just is a masterpiece. It does not try to be complex and clever. It actually started out something simple and then became clever just between the basically Mike Halichuk and Jonah Falco's vision and luck and skill.
You know, something that lends a lot of a lot of evidence to what you just said. There was I don't know if you use Instagram, John. It's a horrible thing. It's a horrible thing. But I was looking at one of these quick hit goofy Instagram stories things that Fucked Up did the other night, and they did a little Q&A where people sent them questions and they answered them. And someone asked, was it a video or what was it? I am too old to understand even what an Instagram story is. So let's just say it's a thing in which text and images and stuff potentially appears on a screen for a little while and then doesn't.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So they answered a bunch of little questions that people had sent in, just like big font, short answers, short questions. And someone asked, like, how many songs that they had written for this. And their answer was 50. I don't know if that means they recorded 50 songs or what, but there's your Sandinista right there. Like, they had 50, you know, independent pieces of music that were at some stage in their life cycle as they're putting this thing together. And that's pretty nuts. The final song that I listened to before the universe decided that I wasn't allowed to listen to music anymore was track 16 on this thing, which is called Came Down Wrong, which features two of the record's guests on it. And I know both these artists. I'm sure you know the latter one, and it just had, I was just transported, John. The last track that I heard here, it features Jay Maskus. Who's Jay Maskus, John?
Well, that's Dinosaur Jr., Adam, as well as the obscure Masters of Reality. So,
yeah, all right, there you go. You've obscured it up. But everyone knows Jay Maskus. Everyone knows the voice, right? So it's got Jay Maskus on there and has Jennifer Castle. Now, Jennifer Castle probably doesn't ring too many bells in the punk rock universe if you're not, I don't know, part of like the Canadian indie scene in any which way. But there's certain, I don't know if this is the true for you, but it's true for me. There's certain artists, John, that no matter how old they actually are or how old I actually am, I always feel like a child and they always feel like an adult. And I'm never going to see them as someone that would be, you know, part of my peer group or my cohort or anything. Like, they just exist on another plane.
You know who else expressed that same exact statement? Ian MacKaye and Led Zeppelin.
Ooh, okay. That's very interesting. So there's certain people like that where I feel that, like, even if I were to be able to, like, get to know the person, I'd almost not want to, because I would feel weirdly inadequate trying to just have a casual conversation with them. So for me, someone like Patti Smith is in that boat. Like, I sort of picture Patti Smith as operating on this level that I am not allowed to achieve, and I don't want to interact with them. You know, I don't want to, like, send, like, goofy Twitter messages to Patti Smith like I would, say, some doofus in a punk band, right? I have, like, an artistic reverence for her that I don't want to break, because, like, I feel that she's just, she occupies some higher plane, right? And Jennifer Castle for me is one of those people where the two records that she released last, which were Angels of Death and Pink City, they're you know, alt country folk records, you know, very quiet at times, very gentle, but very, you know, a little bit meditative, but there's something about just the tone of her voice, or the way that she carries herself on stage, and the way that she carries herself, like, as an artist, and interacts or doesn't interact with, you know, the internet and everything, that I don't know, man, like, Jennifer Castle is like a person I revere for reasons I can't quite explain. So to hear her all of a sudden, like, pop up on this record and then just nail it within the context of the song that she's in, and then sing, like, a duet with Jay Mascis, is just, it's something I've not processed properly. But and I feel like there's a lot of this record that I'm not going to process properly for a while. Like Mechanical Bull, which is a crazy industrial song, features Ryan Tong, who sings in a Toronto hardcore band called Shit. And, like, you would never expect to hear him show up on something like this. This is just a weird, wild record. Track 18, which I haven't heard yet because the universe sucks, has Lito Pineda on it. There's a handful of other guests on here that I'm still trying to pick out where they are. And yeah, this is a pretty, pretty crazy record. It's a pretty nuts record.
It's fantastic, Adam. It's a record that is all over. Actually, it doesn't feel like it's that. I mean, it's got a lot of different things. Like, Sandinista is all over the place, you know? This record doesn't feel like it's all over the place. It just feels like it's the band doing, kind of morphing and evolving as the record goes along. To me, it all feels very much that it fits in place. It's daring, but it's daring but calculated, if you will, or daring but with a, not calculated, it's daring but it has a mastercraft hand at the rudder to make sure it doesn't spin off, you know, off course. It stays on course. I would say one of the most fun things about this album for me is there's so much imagery, so much symbolism, so much, you know, maze within maze within maze tied together, and there's not one string that unravels at all. Not everything is answered. Some things are answered. Some things contradict each other. And this is just the kind of record that you can really just check out for decades and keep finding new things and really explore and, you know, enjoy for a long, long time. But not only that, it's also to a lot of the tracks are immediate, and that's kind of tough to do on a record like this. I wanted to say one other thing. What was that? Well, I can't remember. Anyway, it's freaking great. I was surprised at some reviews. I was surprised that it got mostly good reviews. It got two bad reviews. Rolling Stone gave them a mediocre review, although it was kind of negative. And Pitchfork positioned it as a mediocre review, but the review itself is entirely negative, which really surprised me. And well, that follows in Pitchfork's style, you know, talk about how great something is, you know, while it's building up, and then maybe, you know, keep talking about how great it is while they put out something great, but after they put out something great, just, you know, piss all over them, which is absurd. This album is clearly, I love Chemistry of Common Life, Adam. I love Chemistry of Common Life, but I think I like this one better. I think it is better. Not that you have to compare everything, but for someone to say that this record is a misfire, or that it's, you know, not achieving what they're hoping to achieve is short-sighted and, quite frankly, incorrect. This is a band firmly in control. It's effed up excelling at what effed up can excel at uniquely to the highest degree, if you ask me. And I'm excited for all the side projects that are a part of this, because there are many more to come out, apparently. And I've got a couple of them, and it is cool.
Yeah, I saw that you had linked that Pitchfork review in particular in your ire, and I can't bring myself to go read it.
Don't bother. It's that guy that really trashed Ceremony, like, really bad. Ceremony put out an album called L-Shaped Man, which was okay. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't great. It was okay. But to Ceremony's credit, they were trying something new, and I will never fault a band for trying something new and daring, which Ceremony was trying to do. And the review was just – actually, it's probably one of the top 10 meanest reviews of all time in any publication of note. I mean, there's zines where there's mean reviews, but it was an extremely mean but also an extremely inaccurate and misguided review. And that writer is kind of known for doing that. And what's interesting about that writer is that, like, some bands love him, and they're like, oh, so-and-so, he's so nice. And I know some of these bands. I'm like, he's not nice. Him being nice to you is not the same as being nice, you know. And so I think he wrote the review not as whether or not the record was actually good, and he didn't even write the review as whether or not he actually enjoyed it. He wrote the review as, can I find a way from an intellectual standpoint to position this as bad as opposed to good. And what I'm saying is, he made a legal argument in that in law, one party says it's A, one party says it's B. You find. And if you're a lawyer on either side, it doesn't matter what you really think, because you represent your client. So you find the evidence and the legal arguments to position as I'm right or no, I'm right. So what this writer did, which in the review context I think is bad, is he said, well, everyone else is saying this is good, so I'm going to say it's bad. Let me see how I can spin things to make the argument this is a bad record when it's not a bad record. Does that make sense, Adam?
No, I get that. I've been thinking a lot about this because I have somehow found myself in this odd this odd position of doing a talk on the weekend in a library.
Adam, let me pause you, Adam, and you can bounce off of this. Listen, people, Adam talked about this a little while ago, and I kind of brushed past it. Adam White is doing this newsletter called Some Party, where he talks about all the coolest Canadian bands. He's doing a fantastic job with it. Even if you're not in Canada, you should subscribe to this newsletter, because it's got a lot of cool, obscure, weird stuff. And Adam, you are doing a fantastic job with Some Party.
Thank you. That's what you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, why? Because you it was like 2 or 3 weeks ago. You were like, I was at that festival and I saw Some Party and I was so proud. And then I kind of like said, oh, that's cool. And then I started talking about the Melvins or Hawkwind or something. And I realized that, like, you were kind of saying, like, oh, I'm very proud of this, which you should be. You've done an excellent job. And I feel as though myself and maybe the other host as well could have fanned a little bit more adulation upon you, which I think you deserve for that newsletter. So people should go definitely check out Adam White's newsletter of Canadian music, because it is cool and interesting, and it will have stuff that you've never had before.
Thank you. That's very nice. So one of the people that subscribes to said newsletter apparently works at the library in Niagara Falls, the city I live in. And so they sent me an email a few months ago, and they were like, they participate in this thing that I guess all the public libraries do on this coming weekend, which is the... Oh, what's the hashtag? John, what's the fucking hashtag? I don't know. It's Indie Writers Week or Indie Writers something or whatever. There's some sort of international, like, festival of writing that they're doing. It is Indie Author Day is what it is, right? So they're bringing in a bunch of people from various stripes that write stuff and having them do, you know, little hour talks with whoever happens to show up at the library in in the middle of the afternoon on a Saturday. I don't know who that is, and I'm trying not to joke too much about it because I'm rather flattered for being asked, but there's a part of me that, like, really hopes I get there. And there's a bunch of unruly teens that have been roped into coming in and watching these talks. And I'm going to turn a chair around and talk to teens at the library about music writing.
Well, you have to be wearing a what do you call it, a button up shirt with a tie but no jacket. You roll up your sleeves, you spin the chair around, you sit down with your arms crossed over the back.
Yeah,
of the
I'm gonna rap with them, John. Anyways, though, so I'm giving this talk, and oh god, how'd I get onto this? Oh yeah, so I'm giving this talk. Now I have the secret boring past history of doing a lot of public speaking for a few years. So I like doing that quite a bit. And something like this, I'm not going to prep anything outside of like a couple bullet notes for myself because, you know, I can clearly talk for an hour about the thing that I've been doing on and off for the past 20 years. So like, I don't need to, you know, I don't need to do my research on that. But I was scribbling down some notes just to make sure that I had some semblance of a flow to what kind of points I wanted to nail on. And one of the things that I want to talk about, and this is interesting kind of given what you just brought up about Pitchfork there, was I wanted to talk a little bit about the difference between curating music and doing music criticism. And how there's sort of two different things, and they're not necessarily the same, and where they cross over. And like there's an interesting sort of contrast here that we can draw. So if you look at, say, Pitchfork, right? Pitchfork's trying to do music criticism, right? They're not particularly curating stuff for you in this sense, especially with this, say, this fucked up record. They want to take what's coming out. They want to make sure that it's something that people have somewhat heard about in a lot of cases. And then they want to kind of put it under the microscope, then dissect it and, you know, adjudicate on whether it's good or not. Right. So you have to say Pitchfork taking that standpoint. If you want to say contrast that to what I'm doing on Some Party, I'm doing very little to no criticism on Some Party. I'm curating and exposing stuff, right? I'm going and I'm saying, you know, here's, you know, it's a busy, busy world. Here's all this crazy stuff that's come out in the past week that you may not have heard. You know, go check it out. And I'm seldom throwing my opinion into it. But more than that, I'm also not sharing stuff that I don't think is interesting, right? And I think that's one of the differences that you like, say, as an independent writer can choose to, you know, you can choose to go down one road or the other here. So for example, you know, my stuff that I'm writing is all about Canadian music, but I'm not writing about all of it. And there are bands that are, you know, that are even punk bands that are within the Canadian music realm that just like, you know, all the power to them, but I don't give a shit about what they're doing, right? There's a band that's on, is it Victory? Is it Dino? I don't know what it's on. There's a band called Seaway from somewhere south of Toronto in Ontario here that, you know, probably perfectly nice folks. They're making just this flavor of pop punk that was from an era after I grew out of being into adolescent pop punk, and I just can't do it. Just the emo influenced, you know, high vocals, you know what I'm talking about, John. And it's just not a me thing. So they just get omitted because I don't care to talk about them. Like they're not something that fits into this pantheon of bands that I'm trying to draw a line around. And there's a subtle criticism that you get when you're doing curation with regards to what you're ignoring, with regards to what you're leaving out, with regards to what you're omitting. But that's a very different thing than saying, okay, I'm going to take what's available and take what's notable and I'm going to judge it. And I'm not saying one thing is better than the other because Punk News Reviews, you know, clearly follow along the same line as the Pitchfork thing. But just as an independent, as someone, say, writing something solo, how far you go down one road or the other road really colors the overall tone of the publication that you're trying to do. And it can really mess up your mission statement if you all of a sudden switch gears from doing something, you know, curation based all of a sudden into criticism. And there's a huge, like, there's a huge burden when all of a sudden you jump into criticism, because it means that, okay, well, you're no longer just, you know, omitting stuff because it's not noteworthy. It means you sort of have to take on the stuff that you don't like that is noteworthy and then express that. Like, it's a different slate of responsibilities that you're taking on. So I don't know. I've been thinking about that. It's all been knocking around in my head. And that pitchfork thing kind of exemplifies that.
Well, there's one way you can solve this, Adam. Just tell anyone that it's $50 per star up to 5 stars. So if they want 1 star, then you're $50. If they want 2 stars, it's 100, 350, 200, and 5 stars is $250. And there you go. You know,
that may make sense. All right, here, play a song, and then we'll come back and do the mail. We're gonna be all over the place.
Okay, yeah. So listen, unlike Adam, who's been on the tip of the happen to new music in Canada every week, for the past 6 months or 12 months or maybe even 18 months, there haven't been that many new bands that have blown my mind. I mean, about 4 or 5 years ago when I was going to house shows 2 or 3 times a week, I saw Bad Canoes. I saw Crazy in the Brains. I saw Funeral Cone. I saw all these bands that were just blowing my mind. I'm like, holy crap. But lately, it seems like past year or so, 18 months, not a whole lot of bands has really shocked me. And that's because I haven't been going to that many house shows. I've been gone to, or underground shows or DIY shows. I've been going to like bar shows and bigger shows, which is fun and it's cool. But it's rare that you see something new there that's really going to blow your mind. Because usually at those kind of concerts, most of the bands there already have been around for a while, so you've heard of them or you vaguely know of them. I went to a Cousin Danny's in Philadelphia, which is a licensed venue, but it's very, very DIY. And there was this band there called Sial, S-I-A-L, S-I-A-L. And the band is from Singapore. And it's a young lady and 3 young gentlemen. And they are from Singapore. And Adam, what's one big difference between Canada, America, and Singapore?
Hemisphere.
True. And therefore, no, this is very...
Is that even true? I'm not sure now.
Yeah, well, Eastern and Western Hemisphere, sure.
Oh, okay. I was thinking north-south. Never mind.
So two hemispheres. But anyways, I didn't know this. I was actually talking to the young lady in the band after the show. Singapore has no constitution. And so basically, like, there's no rights against, you know, unlawful search and seizure. There's no – like, if the police want to come arrest you and take you downtown, they can, you know. If you're saying something the government doesn't like, the government can shut you up, you know. And Singapore isn't like, you know, North Korea, but it's, you know, it's got its issues. It's got its good part too, of course, but it's got severe issues. So, you know, in America, well, in America, freedoms are being taken away and that kind of a thing. But in America, you pretty much can execute free speech if you want to do that. You know, you can say, I hate cops, I hate Trump, which you should be able to do. Singapore, not so much. So a punk band in Singapore is kind of riskier, but also maybe more bold, especially a punk band with a young woman and a punk band with a young woman in a predominantly Muslim area in Singapore, and the lead singer is a Muslim woman, and so there's that issue too, because you don't see a whole lot of, I guess, there are some, but you don't, there's fewer Muslim punk bands than there are non-Muslim punk bands, if I can put it that way.
I feel that, like, however little we know about this place, it feels like doing a punk band, like, sort of anywhere outside of the, you know, where punk has been completely absorbed into the, you know, into the cultural story and bypassed by everything else, is probably a more daring thing. I would like to say also, John, that Singapore is like just north of the equator, so I'm wrong.
It's funny because, like, I'm like, all right, I'm not going to be a boneheaded American, and I'm like asking her questions about Singaporean culture. So like I'm trying to learn about Singapore. You know what I mean? Because whenever I've gone to other countries, they like want to learn about America, and they want you to learn about them. So I didn't want to do the bonehead American thing where I'm like, oh, so, you know, X, Y, Z. I'm like, well, why don't you tell me about this? Why don't you tell me about that? But I think maybe I was being a little too. I'm like, so what do your parents do? You know, and like I was interviewing. But I think maybe she wasn't quite that comfortable, you know. I'm like, so what do your parents do? What's your job? You know, do you like it? You know, so I was really trying to get an idea about the area, you know. So anyways.
Like, do you have hamburgers in Singapore? Like,
well, I'm like, so what time do you wake up? You know, what's your average day like? You know, like, I wasn't trying to be weird or mean. I was trying to understand Singapore from the ground level up. Anyways. The other thing about this band is they're Malay. And Adam, I sort of knew this, but I didn't know. Do you know what Malay culture is, Adam?
Like from Malaysia?
Right. Well, yeah, and we don't really have a great understanding of this in the United States. You see some of it in Europe is, and you know, you're from Italy, you're Italian. You're from Germany, you're German. You're from France, you're French. But in some parts of Europe, but even more so in the Eastern world, just because someone's from an area doesn't mean they're that culture. They're a culture. That is the Malay culture, the Malaysian culture, is a group of people that exists in Malaysia, but also outside of Malaysia as well. Kind of like Romani people in like Eastern Europe, that kind of a thing. You know what I mean? And so
yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of difficult to grasp an understanding of that. The point being is the band, all the lyrics are in Malay, so I don't know what the hell they're saying, but it sounds cool. They've got a new 7-inch out. It's pretty good. Oh, actually, it's real good. It's sonically, it might not blow your mind. I mean, it's very good, but it's not radically different than other things you've heard before. If you can see this band live, you've got to see them live because they are amazing live. But also, when you're listening to this record, keep in mind that these are people from Singapore. They're Malay. They've got a female front singer, and they're making a point to sing in Malay instead of English or Chinese. And that's kind of making a statement in and of itself. So this is a track by Seal. I think they're a great band. They're on tour now. You should go see them because who knows when they're going to come back to the States. This is Seal, Sial.
See y'all. So if anyone wants to send us email, you can do that at podcast@punknews.org. We got any mail to talk about this week?
Let's just bing through one because we've got another one about ska, but maybe we'll save that for next week because it's a long discussion, the ska one. So we'll just read the other one real quick. You can reach us at podcast@punknews. Oh, here it is right here. All right. This is from Star F Raps, who has written in before. Hello. Love the podcast and everyone who participates in it. But this one is mostly for John and Adam. I'm currently attending a school for audio engineering, and as such, all students are required to take a course in copyright for intellectual property, which I have just started this week. I just want to write in to say that I didn't realize how much baseline knowledge I had gained and retained just from listening to the podcast over the years and hearing John and Adam elaborate on the many copyright and trademark cases in the music world. I really enjoy the professional flavor your job adds to the discussion in the podcast, and the same goes for Adam. Even when it's not necessarily relevant to the punk world, for example, talking about error return codes, I always find it fascinating and fun to listen to and appreciate what you guys have to offer. Keep on being rad, from Star F Raps. And he says, shout out to the new Living End album, which is really good, from Star F Raps.
Wow, the Living End. Holy fuck. I haven't heard about that band in a while. That's all. Did the Living End not have like a handful of years where they had a few, or maybe just one record, where they had like a couple big singles in the American world, and then they never caught on, and you know, the North American music industry decided they stopped existing?
I couldn't say, Adam, because I recently found another copy of the Beastie Boys Custom Mix Greatest Hits CDs used for $8. So I've deleted all other knowledge of all other bands in my brain because I was so happy to get my seventh copy of the Beastie Boys Unique Mix Greatest Hits.
Well, whatever record like Prisoner of Society was on, I feel that like that was a big radio hit here. And this is probably one of these situations where that band has had like 19 records in Australia that's come out since then. So that's, yeah, I should circle back and see where the hell they went. Thank you for that letter. That was cool. I'm glad you liked the HTTP error codes thing, because I'm sure no one else did. Yeah, that's cool. No, John, we should make it clear here that no one should take anything that we say about how copyright law works and do anything about it.
It's not legal advice. It's being prevented for provided for entertainment value only.
Yes, because oof, we were probably wrong.
And don't sue us. And if you sue us in Canada, not the United States.
Yeah, it's nicer up here.
Lawsuits are much more pleasant in Canada.
They're more polite. All right. All right. So let's talk about some of the news and stuff that happened this past week. If you want to email us, podcast@thepunknews.org is how you do that. If you're a guy that sent us a cool email about ska, we'll get to that next week. We will get to some ska later this episode, though. So, John, I moved our fucked up story. So the first story I'm actually going to read is about. And I didn't even know there were videos on this. Okay, here we go. So, on Saturday, this is the Saturday past, I guess when we're recording this, there was a music festival that happened in Camden, New Jersey, called the Rock Allegiance Fest, and it featured I say quote unquote bands that you may have heard at some point in your life. Now, John's buddies, Guar, were there, so I ain't speaking no ill about Guar. But it had your Papa's Roach and your Insane Clowns Posse and your Limp Bizkit and all that kind of stuff happening. But during all of this this crazy rap rock fervor, during the Limp Bizkit set in particular, the ICP member Shaggy Two Dope, can't believe I'm reading this, ran out on stage and tried to drop kick singer Fred Durst. He almost connected, but he miscalculated the I guess distance that he could execute a flying kick in, and he kind of like he flopped down before he got him. Neither side issued a statement, but you can actually see videos of the attack over on Punk News or on YouTube right now. I John, I'm going to watch this live while you comment on this. And oh my God, I haven't seen a picture of Fred Durst in 10 years, and he looks like he lives in the mountains now.
He looks kind of like Tim Armstrong now.
He does kind of look like Tim Armstrong. He still has a fucking bucket hat, though.
Well, anyways, someone on Facebook or the Punk News site or whatever, they're like, he went to kick and he missed, and he's trained. How disgusting that that Shaggy Two Dope is a trained wrestler, but he can't even do a drop kick. First of all, I will say it's impressive how much air Shaggy Two Dope got. I mean, he's like 50. That's a pretty good drop kick for a 50-year-old. However, I gotta say my bullshit detector is mostly going off on this. It's mostly going off because if you're attacking someone, especially a sneak attack, you're not gonna drop like a drop kick isn't like a real attack. If you drop kick someone, you're going to get hurt because you're going to hit the ground after you kick the person. I mean, if you're trying to hurt someone, you're going to tackle them or smash into them or smash in the back of the head with your fists. You know, you're not going to drop kick. Like the drop kick is a kick designed for like showmanship in professional wrestling. And of course, Shaggy Two Dope doesn't actually hit Fred Durst. But so someone says, well, he's trained to do this. If he's trained to drop kick, it also means he's trained to make it look like he's doing a drop kick, but he's not actually connecting, which might be the case here. However, there's a couple of things going against that is that immediately after the drop kick attack, like the bouncers really do grab him and they're like fighting with like another guy. Like it looked like the scuffle was real after the attack. And also Fred Durst kind of he seemed actually surprised because after he was drop kicked, it looked like Shaggy Two Dope's foot kind of just tapped him. Like, he turned around and seemed confused because he didn't know what happened because he just felt something on his back. So if it was planned, you think he'd be, like, aware that he was about to get fake drop kicked or whatever. So I gotta say, if this is some kind of scam or publicity thing, kudos to Shaggy 2 Dope and Fred Durst, because I honestly can't tell if this is real or not. If it is real, it's like, why are two grown men drop kicking each other? Like apparently they've hated each other since like 2000 or something. When Fred Durst kicked Shaggy 2 Dope off a tour. But is this the time and the place to settle it? And also, Adam, this is what I find most amusing about this, if it's real. Shaggy 2 Dope is rich, and actually, he's more rich than pretty much anybody else we talk about on this podcast all year long, and he's actually richer than a lot of celebrities you'll see on TV, and he's richer than most politicians you'll see on TV. He's a rich, rich man. Adam White, could you foresee the Wozniak, or could you foresee Bezos running out and drop kicking his like opposition? Like Shaggy 2 Dope is a rich man, but I'm proud of him for keeping to his roots and being willing to drop kick someone else he has a grudge on, man to man, instead of hiding behind legal papers and filings.
Before I comment, I'd like to say for the listeners, I also have no idea why we're talking about this.
And you know why we're talking about this? Because it's hilarious.
All right, it passes the John Whimsy filter, I guess. I mean, I think we are in the age when rich people of all stripes are going to do crazy bullshit. Because I would give you Elon Musk would totally try to dropkick someone.
You think Elon? I mean, for real. Do you think? I know Elon Musk is kind of wacky. And
you don't think so?
Do you think he would fist fight someone? I don't think Elon Musk has the balls to fist fight someone. Like, I really don't. Like, I think he would get scared. Like, actually, like, I actually think Trump. Well, actually, I don't know about Trump, but like other rich assholes, some of them would fist fight. I don't think Elon Musk would fist fight.
Oh no, I don't think he would go get in a legitimate fist fight as a means of settling a problem. But I think he is totally the kind of personality that would both A, assume they could just execute it like a flying drop kick successfully, but B, would assume that doing it out of the blue would fit their mad genius persona and not in any way damage their corporate standing or anything like that.
So you think Shaggy 2 Dope is a mad genius?
He may consider himself a mad genius. I mean, like, we're in this realm where, like, all the rich people aren't – they're not classic rich people anymore. They're not these old they're not these like, old Republican CEOs that are going to sit around and smoke cigars at the country club. They're all these – tech bros that are half children in the first place, and those are exactly the kind of people that grew up playing Mortal Kombat and just assuming that they're can Johnny Cage their way out of a situation. So yeah, I totally see lots of rich people doing that these days.
Fair enough.
Are we gonna talk about some punk rock, or are we gonna talk
do you think it's real or fake? And honestly, like, you got to give the Shaggy 2 Dope. That was a pretty impressive drop. Like, that was a professional wrestler quality drop.
Oh, I would say it's real, because if you were going to fake drop kick someone off a stage, in the middle of a big goofy rock show, you would have probably tried to, stage it out like a pro wrestling kind of thing, right? Like make a big show out of it. You wouldn't just want to like fall on your face and have everyone look at you confusingly. So I say real.
Fair enough.
I don't know why, but it's probably real.
Adam White, not to drag this out, but everyone used to hate Insane Clown Posse. Then everybody loved Insane Clown Posse, both ironically, but also as a representation of the misfit that has learned to make his place in the world. What's your stance on Insane Clown Posse?
I had always just assumed that they were for, this is going to be very classist, but strange, dirty trailer people who I don't associate with. But, ever since the Juggalos decided that they were going to fight the Nazis, I'm fucking on board. I'm on their side. I'm not going to listen to their shit, but, if I had to choose between hanging out with a bunch of Juggalos or hanging out with a bunch of you know, Richard Spencer types, you know, juggalo all the way.
Fair enough, fair enough.
John, do you hang out on the websites of various clothing labels to suss out their indiscretions against the punk rock world?
Actually, yes, I do. Because let me, well, do you want to introduce it? You want to tell you how I got
here? Yeah, I want to introduce this because I feel like this is something that came from you whole cloth. And correct me if I'm wrong there. So their Diesel is a clothing company. It's also a form of hydrocarbon fuel that you can put in a truck. But Diesel is a clothing company, international clothing company. They sell luxury clothes. Sometimes those clothes cost over $1,000 an article. Sheermag is a Philadelphia punk band that often addresses economic inequality and capitalistic exploitation in their music. Well, recently, Diesel, they debuted a new line of pants called the Black P. Frank Patch Trousers. These are $350 pants. They have they're covered in an assortment of quasi-punk patches and symbols and other rigmarole that's sewed onto these pants. And one of those patches in particular is, it could be nothing else but a ripoff of Sheermag's logo, which, if you've ever seen it, is pretty distinctive. So this follows a recent trend that John's been chasing of high-end clothing companies borrowing punk logos and sticking them on expensive clothes, and bands like Crass, Against Me, and Sham 69 have all each faced that issue in recent times with, you know, all sorts of high-end fake punk jackets and this and that kind of getting into the mix. But this story, John, I saw this reported elsewhere. And when reported elsewhere, credited back to punknews.org, which says to me, this is a John Gentile investigative report.
For my real job, one of the things that I do is I represent artists and bands when their intellectual property has been stolen. A big part of that is representing photographers, and another smaller part of that is representing bands when their IP has been ripped off. Usually it's in the form of a t-shirt design, but sometimes it's rare. Actually, rarely it's music, but sometimes, and semi-rarely, but not that rare, it's unauthorized logo usage. Adam, I'm currently representing another band that I cannot name, a fairly well-known band, that has had their very anti-capitalistic band that has had their logo ripped off, and I was going through looking for other unauthorized uses of their logo, but also previous unauthorized logos by against unauthorized uses of other bands by high-end fashion companies to really drive the point home so I can get the maximum dollar for my client. And I'm just going through clothing, and I come across the damn Sheermag logo, like, out of the blue. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, holy shit, that's the Sheermag logo. What are the chances? It's particularly amusing because Sheermag is very anti this exact kind of thing. They even have a song being against sweatshops and you know, clothing made in Singapore or Haiti and that kind of a thing.
So the alternate telling of this is that you were online shopping for some fancy lawyer pants and you just happened to stumble upon this, and you're like, oh no shit,
these pants are hideous, aren't they?
I don't get it at all. I mean, the you usually when you see one of these, they're at least trying to, you know, come up with the approximation of a piece of punk clothing. And I'm trying to find one of the past ones that we've talked about. So here, what was this one? Barney's New York was selling $1,000 jacket with a Sham 69 patch on it. And I mean, that's not a great looking jacket either, but like there have been iterations of this that have at least looked something like, you know, the patch and stud covered leather jacket that you'd see at a punk show. This just looks like ass. Like,
I think I'm not as
fashion. Poorly executed.
I'm not a fashionista, but this is, I've sort of noticed this more so with guys than with girls, but maybe with girls too, is it's like for very high end, I guess you would call, you wouldn't call this, would you call this casual? What would, or I guess just high end is what you would call it, high end clothes. It like, it looks hideous on purpose. The underlying message is I'm such an attractive person that I can wear clothes that look like dog shit, but I still look cool because I'm a handsome person. Like, I've been out in the town or whatever, and I've seen beautiful, beautiful girls with these guys, and it looks like they got, like, sweat, literally wearing, like, sweatpants that you would buy at, like, Goodwill, you know, and, like an old, rumpled-up sweatshirt, and, like and the pants are, like, hoisted up above their belly button, and, like, just look like I'm not making fun of homeless people, but they look like homeless people, you know. And I think it's like a statement that says I'm so handsome that I can wear horrible, hideous, expensive clothing that is way too much than it should be, and I still look good because I'm that handsome. I think that's what it's saying, Adam. And there's always the option of the emperor's new clothes, which now more than ever seems to be the case in many situations.
This is, yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's not my world, John. If anything, I'm wearing the sweatpants from Goodwill, so I'm not.
Have you noticed that, though, Adam? Like, really good looking women with guys that are dressed up at like hobos. Have you noticed that? Or is it just like a Philadelphia thing, maybe?
I've stopped trying to understand any fashion at all at this point in my life, because there's whole trends that, I mean, that have happened like in the youth culture that I'm not allowed to touch, and I don't get them, and I don't know if I'm supposed to get them. Like this like all the normcore stuff that happened, like all the girls started wearing mom jeans and things like that, and I'm like, I don't get why this is. I don't get that. Does this look good ironically? I don't get it. And then, but I don't think I'm supposed to get it because I'm old. So I can't imagine that these pair of pants that you have highlighted here are indicative of anything that the greater culture is trying to achieve. I really hope not. These are gross.
These are hideous. I mean, they're so ugly. Like, the pants are ugly, and the organization of the patches is ugly too. It's horrible. They look like dungarees.
That's the thing. It's like when I always kind of thought this was adorable, but when you are at a show and someone comes in with, you know, with like a $5 denim jacket that they have acquired from somewhere that they have meticulously covered in, you know, 9 rows of spikes, you know, followed by a, you know, I don't know, like a big crimp shrine patch or something like that, right? Like, they put a lot of work into that. Like a lot of the, like, we write it off and we're like, oh, look at these, like, you know, scuzzy old punk guys and their dirty, you know, denim spike jacket. But those guys spent a lot of fucking time, you know, placing things and making sure that that's going to go where it's going to go. If, I mean, that may not be your particular bag as far as fashion goes, but you can't say it's haphazard. Like, none of these punks putting patches on their shit are doing it haphazardly. They're thinking too much about it, if anything. But this looks haphazard. This looks like you put the patches on there by, like, shooting them with a paintball gun from across the room.
That's why I think it's, like, ugly on purpose. Like, I think that's the statement. Like, this is hideous, and I'm a daring person and attractive, and that's why I'm wearing these, you know?
Well, really, here's what happens. Diesel, send $1,000 pants or whatever the fuck these are to us, and we will review your pants. We will give you an honest assessment of pants. That's about all we can do.
That would be, honestly, Adam, that would be hilarious if we actually did like a punk's pants review.
Yeah, we'll see if we can we'll see if anyone's going to bite after you've dragged them through the mud. Then they're going to send us free pants. Speaking of free pants, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they just went and announced their 2019 nominees. And there's a lot of bands on here that have been on in recent years but didn't get in. But there's a few on here that I think really should. So the 2019 nominees for induction include Devo, the MC5, Def Leppard, Janet Jackson, John Prine, LL Cool J, Radiohead, Rage Against the Machine, Roxy Music, Stevie Nicks, The Cure, Todd Rundgren, Rufus and Chaka Khan, and The Zombies. They're all on the nominee list. LL Cool J has been nominated 5 times before, but has never actually gotten in. John, you mentioned Kraftwerk.
Oh, yeah, they got nominated, too. They got nominated.
Oh, okay, sure. Kraftwerk, who were also nominated. They've been nominated 4 times before. The MC5 and the Zombies have been on there 3 times. Rufus and Chaka 2. The Cure has been on there before. But, you know, we'll have to see. The induction ceremony will be on March 29th in Brooklyn at the Barclays Center. The only thing about this that makes it interesting for me to talk about is that, like, they should just let Devo in. John, I'm on a Devo kick this year. This is the Adam year of Devo. I've been listening to, you know, new stuff and Devo. That's my world right now. So I say, give them all the spots.
Have you delved into Devo's later years?
No, I'm still exploring the universe of Devo.
Fairly.
Fun
fact, Adam, do you know what famous punk album Todd Rundgren recorded, or produced, rather?
Oh, God, I do know this, but
It's an unexpected guess. It's an unexpected record. And the band hated him for it, but I think he did an amazing job. I can't imagine the album sounding better than it does. I really can't.
What's the answer before I Google it?
New York Dolls, first album.
There you go. So, I mean, just based on, like, Are We Not Men, We Are Devo, I say Devo gets, you know, they get the Oscar here. But anything on here particularly interesting to you? I mean,
We have the same conversation every year.
We do. And like, the conversation is usually like, the MC5 should obviously be in there for, you know, for just if you want to look at this from, like, which of these bands have, you know, influenced future music, then, you know, you would want to say, it makes sense that MC5 would be in there. It makes sense that, say, like, Stevie Nicks would be in there. It, you know, if you want to start getting into the 80s, it makes sense that, you know, The Cure would be in there. It probably makes sense for Def Leppard to be in there, but, you know, that's not my world.
We play the same game every year, and we're always wildly wrong. Adam, we get 7 picks. Who do you think gets in? I'll go first. I'm saying Devo gets in. I'm saying MC5 has to get in because they need the credibility. I'm saying Janet Jackson gets in because people love Janet Jackson. I'm going to say John Prine gets in just because I'm already up to 5 or 4. John Prine gets in because he's kind of, they always go for one person that's not famous and is not that hot, but kind of gives them credibility. LL is going to get in. Radiohead will get in. And Stevie Nicks. Yeah, that's it. Rage won't get in again. Roxy Music won't get in, even though they should. Kraftwerk won't get in, even though they definitely should. And Adam, I've been listening to a lot of Kraftwerk lately. And I don't know what that says. I used to make fun of people that listen to Kraftwerk. But now I've really been enjoying Kraftwerk. All eras. You know, boop, boop, boop. We are the robots. Boop, boop, boop.
Kraftwerk is a weird trip, man. I can see them punting on Radiohead for a few years, right?
Yeah.
That band is still, like, nominally active. You know, they don't need them. And the worst thing, I think, from the Rock Hall's standpoint is that they let Radiohead in, and then Radiohead pulls a cool artist move and then snubs them.
That'd be cool.
And I don't think they want that. I'm trying to think, like, could you see Rage Against the Machine end up in there based on, I don't even know who votes on this shit, but like someone trying to make a political statement?
You mean, could they get voted in through, like, the fan?
Well, could they ride some sort of anti-Trump wave in, even though they're not a Trump era band?
Yeah, but I'm saying, well, they always introduce a hip band. So the hip band is either going to be Radiohead or Rage Against the Machine, even though they're both like really old. Maybe they will pick Rage Against the Machine just because Rage Against the Machine would have a more fiery, explosive live ceremony show than Radiohead, you know. So yes, I can see Rage getting in instead of Radiohead, but I will definitely say it's going to be one or the other, not both.
You know what? Actually, looking at this, I'm going to go Roxy Music.
Oh, I say definitely not Roxy Music. You know, that's one of my favorite bands on this list.
Probably that, my favorite just, band see, on this it, list. It seems like the kind of it's a credibility move. I'm not saying anyone's getting in here because of legitimate reasons. I'm just trying to strategize whatever kind of PR they're trying to get out of this.
And don't forget the fan vote will definitely push through Janet Jackson.
Poor Janet Jackson's had a rough few years. Yeah, she'd get in. She got railroaded, John. Just railroaded after the fucking Super Bowl thing.
She did get railroaded. Yeah, she totally did, man.
It's so yeah, wild. I say dark horse Roxy Music is what I'm going with.
Well, hopefully they'll do an Every Dream Home, a Heartache, and maybe they'll bring Jello up on stage and have Jello sing it with them.
Maybe they will.
And then maybe they'll
say Jello wants to show up as someone's stunt thing.
And maybe they'll be like, "We had such a fun time doing this. We're going to play Punk New Summer Soiree 3, and we'll do it for whatever they want to pay us because we're nice." And that's what's going to happen.
That's totally what's going to happen. So there is a band that is on Deranged Records called Damagers, not Damages, Damagers. They have a new EP out called Victory. It's only shown up on Bandcamp and other digital platforms, maybe just Bandcamp, over the summer. It is supposed to be a 7-inch that someone can go buy, but Deranged hasn't added it to their catalog yet, so I don't know what's going on there. It's really super cool. It's I've listened to it enough that when I go to listen to it, Bandcamp yells at me that I should pay for this. It's one of those. But I'm going to wait for Deranged to actually release that sucker. Now I'm going to go back to Damager's first record. It was a self-titled. It has a super punk rock album cover of, I don't know, someone hitting a skull with a baseball bat. It came out in 2017. It is super, super lo-fi, super, you know, it's sort of like a demo quality thing. Their new thing sounds a lot cleaner, but screw cleaner. So this is from the Damagers self-titled record. It is called, it's self-titled. The song I'm going to play for you. Let's play the song Gimme Damage from Damagers, which is a Toronto-based four-piece. And they at some point have that new EP coming out. So here you go, Damagers, and the song is Gimme Damage. We'll be right back. right, we're back. We got a couple more things we want to talk about before we wrap these things up. John, this next story is a John Whimsy story, if I've ever heard one. You read it off here.
Okay, so the United States band Handguns was on tour in England. During their gig, someone broke into their van and stole a bag. Inside the bag was a wedding ring that band member Jacob Langley had planned to use to propose to his girlfriend/fiancée/wife later on. But the bag was stolen. Tragedy. The next day, a little 4-year-old Bonnie Lewis was out roller skating with her dad at the skate park, and she said, "Daddy, what's that bag over there?" They went over and they found the bag, and inside the bag was the wedding ring as well as all of Jacob Langley's other, his wallet, his contact, his money, all of that was found in the bag. They found Langley and they gave it back to him, and little 4-year-old Bonnie Lewis is now on Handguns guest list for life. The only question I have is, who would break into a van and steal a bag and then not take anything from it? It's weird, but, you know, it's possible, you know.
Looking for drugs.
Yeah, it could be, But a 4-year-old saving the day. And listen, we live in dark times, so it's nice for once in a while. We have a little bit of fun and whimsy and goodness in this world. And 4-year-olds are just over, as Adam White knows, overflowing with sunshine and goodness and happiness. So I was happy for that. And despite all this, despite all that, I was still getting hate in the comments section for posting this story, which is just fun and whimsy and wonderful and great and shows that humans are born good. And it's the world that makes them horrible and evil, so we need to correct that.
Yeah, and the this little girl is now on the lifetime guest list of Handguns.
So she's going to save probably about $16 over the next 80 years.
Well, so I mean, that sort of commits Handguns to remaining a band. Until this poor girl is like old enough to go to a bar and watch them play, so that's a very heroic commitment that they've made there. I don't know. This is fun, a little fun whimsy story. I'm cool in that. We need a little bit of faith in humanity, given that everything else sucks. So,
and you know what? You gotta give Pops credit. Pops would be like, "Oh, I'll take care of it." He could have pocketed the whole thing. He could have made himself an easy $2,000 or $3,000, but Pops did the right thing.
That is very true. So, I don't know. Not too much to talk about on that one. It's a fun little story, though. Gorilla Biscuits. Jumping from a 4-year-old story to Gorilla Biscuits. Here you go. Okay. So, the band recently threw an event. It was an event, not a concert, at Coney Island Baby in New York. The event was to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the band's classic 7-inch. To celebrate, they're going to be releasing... And John, maybe you have a follow-up on this. I don't know. They're going to be releasing some sort of box set that appears to include a reissue of the EP as well as an action figure. Now, here's how the band describes it.
Yeah, and Adam, tell
Super
me,
7 and...
this. I went over this like 4 times. I still couldn't figure out exactly what they were saying. But go ahead and read it. I mean, this is a weird description.
Okay, this is what they said. Super 7 and Revelation Records have partnered together to create a tribute to the amazing longevity of their self-titled 7-inch. This first press tribute box set includes a blue cloth-bound display box with a white foil stamp on the cover. Each box contains a brand new first press tribute blue card Gorilla Biscuits reaction figure with GB logo display base. The GB display base is also a 7-inch large hole adapter which conveniently fits in the new 30th anniversary 7-inch. The 7-inch is pressed on blue vinyl that will match the original first press cover with all new labels and a large hole to fit the adapter. So, hold on here. Oh, I said what happened. The 30th anniversary 7-inch is then wrapped in a fold-out Gorilla Biscuits poster collage. Okay, so as I understand this weird piece of product that they put together, it is a 7-inch. There's a large hole in the 7-inch where you would normally use like a 45 adapter. They have made an action figure that stands on a 45 adapter sized disc that is the band's logo. That disc fits in the record, so you can put the spinning action figure on your turntable to triumphantly rotate around as you play this repress of their first 7-inch. Does that make sense?
I think that's what it is, but why did they write it so weird? You know, why did they just say, we're putting out a box set, it's got the record, it's blue, and it's got an action figure, and the action figure can serve as a 45 adapter? Like, why did they, like, write it so weirdly, you know?
Maybe they're trying to actually, like, sell this to people that are involved in, like, the toys and collectibles universe, and to them, they got to gussy up all the... all that stuff. Have you seen a picture of this yet? Have we got one?
Only the box itself, and the box is like looks like a book basically. But the other thing is, each box contains a brand new first press tribute blue card Gorilla Biscuits reaction figure. What do they mean blue card? I don't understand that. You know,
I don't know, John. Okay, we're gonna live investigate what the fuck this is on the podcast right now.
I just don't know why they were being so like bizarre. Like, why not just like say. Yeah, but also there's the other thing is, do punk rockers, and especially hardcore guys, do they kind of focus too much on meaningless memorabilia instead of the actual music itself? You know, collecting in hardcore, collecting the actual record is probably the biggest out of any of the punk genres. You see guys dropping $1,200 on a first press, you know, Gorilla Biscuits record or Youth of Today or whatever, but it's like you can buy a later day press for like $7. So, like, why are you so fixated on... Are you living in the past is the question, you know.
Here we go. Thank you, John, on Instagram. Here we go. I have a photograph of this item. Okay. The action figure is the gorilla. It is packaged like an action figure, like it is in a little, like, plastic blister pack kind of thing, with a little, you know, like completely authentic, with it, like it has the little hanger where you would put them on the racks at the toy store, the little hole cut in the top of the box, and yeah, it comes with a little disc that it stands on. The disc that it stands on seems too big to actually fit in a record, but hey, I'm not in charge here. John, because this is super interesting to hear people to hear us use the internet, I'm going to send you this picture right now, and I would like you to comment on it.
Adam, should I buy the Crimson Gross action figure that's $15? I kind of want to buy one, but it's like, why? You know, I'm a grown man. I don't need to be buying toys. But it would be kind of cool to have an action figure, the Crimson Ghost.
I worry about this as someone that grew up as a weird comic book nerd, that if I give in to that impulse ever, then it's a slippery slope. John, I somehow YouTube has decided that I need to see videos where weird nerds dissect the fictional histories of various ships from Star Trek. And I've given into this, and I'm like, ooh, okay. I'm like, yeah, I want to see this guy talk about the, you know, the history of the Intrepid class or some shit like that, right? And I'm sitting there, I'm doing dishes, I'm watching this stupid YouTube video, and then in the YouTube video, all of a sudden it like breaks to an ad, and they're like, buy these little Star Trek cast iron ships, you can get all of them, and they sit on your desk, and. There's like 4 seconds of my life where I went, woo. It's like, no, that's not the kind of person you are. Don't buy that shit.
One of the bigger regrets I have is this guy made a Steve Ignorant action figure under the approval of Steve Ignorant to raise money for CPALing, which is what Steve Ignorant did. And it only went for like $80, and I bid on it to win. But because I was in the United States, I had to like register before I bid, and I didn't win. And I would have loved to have the one-of-one Steve Ignorant action figure of Crass. I regret that quite a bit, Adam. Anyway, this Gorilla Biscuits, yeah, it's cool. You know, it's amusing, but it is a toy. And honestly, with this kind of thing, I do wonder, does this kind of take away from the import of the album? By making toys and silly little things, does that kind of trivialize this thing that to us is considered very important. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too much of a hard ass. This is just kind of fun and amusing. Yeah, I'm being a hard ass. This is fun and amusing, and if people want to get it, they should get it. I'm not gonna get it, but it's amusing. I'm trying to think if they made Melvin's action figures, I would buy them, honestly. You know, if they
yeah, I think that you and me are old enough that when you say if they made Melvin's action figures, you mean something different than what the world would produce right now, because you see all the time. I don't know, this like bobblehead culture that we live in now. Everything gets, or what are those things? Those yeah, egg-shaped things.
Pops.
Funko Pops or something, yeah, right? Yeah. Where like all manner of pop culture just kind of gets like consumed and made into a weird cartoon character and then barfed out of this collector funnel.
Homogenization machine.
But if I wanted a Buzz action figure, right? I wouldn't want a goofy Mr. Potato Head Buzz.
True.
That you're gonna buy at a comic book store that's shaped like an egg. You want like a over the top 90s McFarlane Toys like Spawn Buzz, you know, that is, you know, intricately over the toply detailed. Like, that was our era of dumb collector garbage, not these eggs that everyone are buying.
I would also settle for early 80s Star Wars action figures that are surprisingly plain looking but charming despite so, or not despite because of.
There was a point in my life where I used to go to a lot of flea markets as a kid, and I remember buying up a lot of the
Star Wars.
Yeah, a lot of those Star Wars action figures, right? Those little ones are like the size of like a G.I. Joe, right? Yeah, but they weren't awesome. Articulated or anything. Not like a G.I. Joe was. But the I remember having a bunch of those, and I remember my brother when the new Star Wars movies or the 90s reissues of Star Wars or whatever came out, they started issuing toys again, and he got one of the new ones. And if you took like Luke Skywalker from those like 70s era Star Wars toys and put them next to the Luke Skywalker from say the 90s ones, in the 90s ones he was jacked. He was shaped like a triangle. He had like giant shoulders and he was really buff. And then if you looked at the one from the 70s, he was all, he looked like an awkward gangly teenager, which is maybe a little bit closer to the truth.
Well, I like the ones from the late 70s. I find them quite charming. And yeah, so if they make Melvin's ones like that or like McFarlane, I will buy them. But if they made Funko Pop ones, I would. I think those are stupid. I really do. I like not everything needs to be cute. You know, I'm sick of shit being cute. Not everything needs to be cute. You know.
John's toys have got to be mean.
I just got put in my place.
Oh, I found a video of the monkey spinning. Okay, here we go. John. Video of the monkey.
Okay,
seeing it in action, I'm down with this now.
Let's see. I kind of wish he like shook his arms, but I'm watching right now. It does look kind of cool.
He moves at a satisfying he moves at the RPM of the record, but like it's appropriate. It looks good. So, anyways,
it's cool.
This has been a weird discussion. All right, before we get out of
here, it's cool.
Yeah, now we're pro this. It's not a Funko Pop. Okay, the Slackers, New York third wave ska band, the Slackers. Do you call the Slackers third wave? I mean, like from that era.
Good question.
But they're not a.
Nah, I mean, they're Hellcat ska, you know, which is not quite the same as third wave ska, you know, even though it's kind of. Well, Hellcat ska came out slightly after third wave ska. So I would say no. I would say if anything, I would say they're retro ska or throwback ska.
Retro ska, you know. Anyway, I have a lot of fond memories of Slackers shows in my life. Anyways, so the Slackers have released a cover of Wrongful Suspicion, which was originally by Rancid off of Life Won't Wait. A record that Vic Ricario from the Slackers had a huge role in. If you ever go study over the... the credits on Life Won't Wait. And if you are Adam White, you totally fucking have. Vic plays on, you know, multiple songs on that record. He has writing credits on a bunch of them. If you ask me, part of what makes Life Won't Wait sound the way it does is just this heavy heaping of like Hammond organ cool that Vic dumps all over whatever Rancid was doing there. So anyways, so they went and took Wrongful Suspicion, which appears in that record. They've covered it. The physical version of this cover is out on November 9th on Batasonic Records. You can listen to the single online right now. John,
Adam,
I really like this.
Me too. As I've mentioned briefly before, in the 70s, bands would do this all the time. There might be a song on the Rolling Stones album that, you know, Ron Wood wrote, and then he would record his own solo version on his own solo album. And is it duplicative? Yes, it is. But it's also fun. It's fun to compare and contrast. And it's kind of this Rancid track with Rancid boiled away and only the underlying songcraft and writers left there. And you can kind of see exactly what the Slackers contributed to it. It gives it a different vibe. And it also goes to show like how powerful of a band Rancid is, or was rather, because their version has a totally different vibe than this, but it also shows how powerful the Slackers are, and that the Slackers version is severely different than the Rancid track, and it's not trying to be Rancid, it's doing something else. And I thought it was cool, and I dug it, and Slackers are cool, man.
I mean, I think you've convinced me, but I actually said I didn't really like this.
Oh, you did? Well, I did. I liked it. I liked it.
No, I liked it in that the Slackers can't really do too much wrong with me. Like, me and them have sort of, they've fallen out of regular, they don't show up in my newsfeed, my personal newsfeed, all too much these days. Like, you know, they seems like a band who's, you know, their heyday for me was back when, you know, Q-Max was with them still. So they've never really felt like the same band to me since he left. But that said, you know, I'll take a Slackers track over, you know, any other modern ska band most of the time. This was fine within that context. You know, it's a nice little Slackers tune. But if there's one thing that I liked so much about the vibe on Life Won't Wait, and the vibe on Wrongful Suspicion in particular, is just how boozy it sounded on that record. And it's partly because, you know, neither Tim or Lars can truly sing, so them doing a big a big sing along like this comes off as more of a drunken party than I think it should. And when you compare it to that, the Slackers version is maybe a little bit too tame, but that's a minor criticism. It's still pretty good. The Slackers are a great band.
I mean, it's kind of what the Slackers, either like it, like the Slackers thing is kind of easy grooving reggae or easy grooving ska, you know.
That's why when Q was with them, it was such a different vibe, because they'd be doing their thing and then he would just be barking at people and yelling stuff and you know, hooting and hollering and everything, and you know, that it was an important part of my college life was seeing the Slackers like three times a year. And like, even though you just got to know all the parts of their set, especially, you know, Q would come out, he'd do the Church of Slack, like you'd all be, the whole crowd would be part of it. Oh, that was fond Adam memories with that. Anyways, though, it's cool. It's just not rambunctious. I was looking for rambunctious.
Well, I mean, if you want rambunctious, I don't think bands that were in their heyday in 1994 in 2018 is the place to go. Unless they want to do a Rancid 5. If they want to do a Rancid 5, then do, but I mean, listen, there's a lot of exciting young bands out there, Adam. There's Seal from
Singapore,
the Northern Hemisphere. there's the Canadian bands that you all enjoy that are based off Devo. So listen, things come and go. Everything's a cycle. And I'm going to ride
all right.
it all night long.
That was good. Are we doing anything else from an audio standpoint, or are we just gonna stick a cap in this?
I know you want to play a song, you know.
Yeah, I can. I gotta find
you want me to play
one.
A song?
Oh God, you're gonna play like a 6-minute reggae thing that people are gonna get mad about. Here,
we'll both play a song. I will play a song that was popular in the 90s and is back again and is excellent now. The Tsunami
it's
Bomb.
Called Africa.
Tsunami Bomb is back. Of course, we've had Tsunami Bomb on the podcast before. We talked about them a lot. They've got a newish singer, but other than the new singer, Kate, the band is actually the original version of the band, which is cool. They put out 2 new singles. It's their first material with Kate on vocals. This track is called Lullaby for the End of the World, and I really like this track. It's off the new Tsunami Bomb 2-track single. And then Adam's going to follow it up with something else. Adam?
Yeah, so there's a 3-piece punk band from Toronto called School Damage. And School Damage, they had a record come out, I don't know, a couple years ago that people seemed to be very into, and then they sort of vanished, or at least they feel like they sort of vanished to me. But they are back. They have a record coming out that they completely made themselves, which is to say that they self-produced, they self-recorded, self-mixed, self-mastered. They are pressing the vinyl with a Bic lighter and a hammer. And the record is called Hello Cruel World. So it's following up their 2016 record Battered Lives. It's 12 songs. It's out this fall on, in the States, it's out on Rad Girlfriend Records. In Europe, it's out on iBuy Records. And then here in Canada, it's on Brain Candy Records. So this is the song We're Dying Dudes. We Are Dying Dudes, not Dues, from the School Damage record, Hello Cruel World. And if you're into melodic hardcore of the Kid Dynamite stripe, then this is the thing for you. So there we go. 2 songs. Twice the song. See you guys next week.